Hello.
Hi, I'm Fabian Thompson.
I'm Richard Barbara.
And we're Class War Games.
And again, this is the wonders of time travel.
Yes, we're now leaping forward 2 weeks in time to speak to you.
Exactly. And yes, well, what's been happening since we haven't been there?
Since we made our last recording half an hour ago.
Or since it hasn't happened, yes. What has happened since it hasn't happened?
Well, I mean, really, there's not, I mean, basically what's happening is we're doing this broadcast. It's going to go out shortly before the Nottingham Carnival,
where I will be dancing on the streets to Channel 1 and KCC and every drum and bass system I can find.
And so we've put off our next session down at the Flea Pit.
In Columbia Road.
Yeah, to the 8th of September.
Yeah, so
Tuesday the 8th of September.
So do come along to on Tuesday 8th of September. We will be playing our Uprising game we're working on.
Yes.
This is our Vienna 1934, Social Democrats versus Catholic Fascists.
Yes, sometimes called the Austrian Civil War.
And actually, so far, it's going well, this development process. And by time the 8th of September comes along, we ought to have a proper working prototype in it.
I think we'll be starting to polish up and finishing the game mechanics. I mean, we've got quite far. Like, the first time we played it, we're happy with how the game started, but then didn't like the middle bit. We've now kind of sorted out the middle bit, I think. We're going to put more detail in, more like side streets, and redesign the board a bit. So I think when we've got a redesigned board, and we've got a clearer idea, we've got to sort out some of the combat stuff as soon as we've got all of that done.
And then we can work on the end game.
Yeah, and then it would be just, you know, the look of the game.
And also playtest.
Exactly.
Because that's the way you make sure in games that there are one good strategy for a side where it always plays the same way. Makes the game very repetitive.
Yeah, so you play the game a couple of times and then you realise actually, as soon as you know what the game's about, A is going to do this, B is going to do that.
Well, we talked about this when we reviewed that Steve Jackson coup game a few weeks ago. And I think that's something you really are conscious from playing games. You must make sure that it can be at least slightly different every time. Otherwise, you're going to run out, you're going to lose interest in it after a while.
Yeah, but I think what we're going to have is actually a game where the different players can offer a range of viable strategies, and then depending on what the other strategy, they can actually be adaptable and change their strategy.
Good.
So you might have the Eisler strategy?
Which is the Social Democrats seize in the centre, or do they hold on to what they've already got, which was what they did do at the time and lost. So we will find out. Come along on Tuesday, 8th of September, Flea Pit.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing we're bigging up is the festival at the HCTB Gallery on 26th, 27th of September.
Exactly. We've got the 2 days for that. And we're going to do the kind of make, do and mend version with Marcel Duchamp Mix Blue Peter.
And Sticky Back Plastic.
Exactly. And it's going to be, that would be fun.
And then on the Sunday is the world premiere of the Class War Games film.
That Ilsa Black is doing.
Sheila's going to come in a few weeks' time and talk all about that.
Yeah, it might even be next week. I don't know. We'll be getting close by the time you're listening to this.
Yeah. So we're going to go over in a minute to talk to Malcolm Hopkins from Houseman Books. This is having bigged up Leisure Games last week. We're now going to talk about one of our favourite shops in London.
Yes, I mean, it has become one of the major left-wing bookshops. It's originally a pacifist bookshop set up back in nearly 50 years ago. In fact, they're going to have the 50th anniversary later on this year. And it's really well worth looking in for a range of, you know, sometimes you wouldn't necessarily want to engage Trotskyists in conversation, but they might have some interesting article in one of their journals that you'd like to read.
So yeah, at the back, because there's sort of books in the front, there's a bit of stationery on one side, there's some nice postcards, other little knickknacks you can buy as presents for people. And at the back they have this collection of all the latest sectarian publications, which is well worth a trawl.
And they also have probably the best, actually, I would say, selection of situationist written material. And I think they've got some DVDs as well from various films and everything like that.
Yes, dodgy recordings of various kinds.
Yeah.
And also, it's sort of arts, politics, culture. Good, highly recommend.
And it's right by King's Cross Railway Station, so it's always been handy for people who maybe people used to come down for demonstrations and they used to pop into Houseman's before they caught the train back home.
Yeah, so it's 5 Caledonian Road, very close to the Scala, if you try and look for it. Yeah. Okay, so over to Malcolm. Are you there, Malcolm?
I am indeed. Hello.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks very much. You can probably hear the traffic going past outside if you listen closely.
Yeah, I see. Right. It is just to give you that authentic King's Cross feel.
Yes. Anyway, I understand it kept you out of the pub for a little while, but you'll be able to go there soon enough.
Quite right, yes. We'll be sucking down there after I've given this can't talk to you.
You'll be a true Guy Debord fan and drink at least 2 bottles of red wine with you in celebration.
That's what we pride ourselves on, yes.
Excellent. Right, well, my first question is, why does a pacifist bookshop sell Guy Debord's The Game of War?
Well, I mean, this is true. I mean, Houseman's is, as you said in your introduction, is part of the Peace News Empire, as we know it affectionately. But historically, Houseman's, the bookshop, has always had a far more wide embracing role, and it sees itself more as the radical alternative sections. And over the years, Houseman's has been involved in numerous campaigns from gay pride. We used to do bookstores with Conflict Crass and all the punks. And interestingly enough, one of the first books on the miners' strike, which was published by Canary Press, emerged from the basement of Houseman's. So that although the parent company, so to speak, is pacifist, the shop itself embraces many, many causes, and it's always historically done that. And for years, there's been a group of people who've been interested in the situation as a... There's a situationist, and it's been a personal sympathy from a lot of people in the shop, so that over the years we have managed to build up a good situationist section, and to a certain extent, you know, stocking the Game of War by Debord poses absolutely no problems either for people working here or most of our customers.
So I suppose if you're selling militarists like books for militarists like Leon Trotsky and Che Guevara, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we sell
playing at war is one thing, but these people are actually engaged in it.
Yeah, we also do sell, you know, Che Guevara's Manual on Guerrilla War and books like that as well. We have a very, you could describe, liberal interpretation of the books we stock. And as you sort of say, we are very non-sectarian in the sense that we don't, anything that comes from a broadly left perspective, we are prepared to stock.
So is it selling well, The Game of War?
It is, yeah. It's done exceptionally well. And also... Uh-huh. Although it probably, I shouldn't say this, it won't go down well with Debord. It sells exceptionally well at Christmas, dare I say.
The party game to keep you going over that long break.
Indeed it is. And I mean, another game that we had which sold exceptionally well was the War on Terror board game as well.
Oh, yes, our friends in Terrible Games.
Yeah, that sells really well. And there again, it was exceptionally popular at Christmas. So I don't know what most of our customers do over Christmas, but I'd rather not think about it.
Well, they want to either conquer the world or learn how to organise a revolution, obviously.
Yes.
That's what we'd like to think, yeah.
So we thought, why do you think people are still interested in Situationism? You know, it's 40 years on from when they were, you know, at their height of intelligent theorising. What does it have to say to us today?
Well, I think there's two reasons for this. One's a sort of historical reason, which we'll start off with. There's a well-known phrase in the poverty student life where they say, since the anarchists will tolerate each other, they'll tolerate anything. However, when the Situationist writings first emerged, it struck a chord with various groups in this country, and this is going back for quite a long time. And luckily, some of those groups decided to keep the material in print, and I'm particularly thinking of the London Psychogeographic Association.
One of whose key members is sitting opposite me.
Well, exactly, but this, you know, basically when the London Psychogeographic Association were publishing their leaflets and their magazines and all that, actually the word psychogeography had quite a limited comprehension. It wasn't quite as well known as it was.
Not like when you sit on the aeroplane now and you read Will Self's little pieces.
Exactly. Then there was also Freddie Perlman of Black and Red, who produced the Society of the Spectacle. Ken Knapp, a Bureau of Public Secrets. And in this country, there were Rebel Press and Dark Star, all of whom kept the Situationist books in print and displayed and used to display them at the Anarchist Book Fair. Because I think it's quite interesting to think that it was only in 1995 that that Soane eventually got round to publishing Donald Nicholson Smith's translation of Society of the Spectacle. But in those intervening years, paradoxically, the libertarian press, despite the fact that De Bord and the Situationists weren't particularly kind to them in written word, the sort of libertarian organisations kept the Situationist profile going. So that there was, although there was far more stuff in print now, it took a long, long time for the more commercial and academic presses to get interested in it. But I think because these groups kept them going, when people began to realise the relevance of it, there was a stream already there. And I mean, I think part of the reason why I think it appeals to a lot of people is because the sort of evolution of the De Bord and the situations, because they came out of and had experience of avant-garde art movements such as Cobra, Lecturism, that they basically completely assimilated Dada and Surrealism and could then move on from it. What they brought to a political critique was a far wider perspective. And I mean, so that they could talk about a critique of culture, the environment, planning, transport, etc., all of which had become very dominant in today's society. Also, their critique of the consumer society, as there was a shift away from production to consumption. And I mean, I think one of the things that also appeals to people, if you think about Van Eygen's book, which is either people either translate as A Revolution of Everyday Life or A Treatise to a Living for the Younger Generation, they're also offering something that I think gives hope to people that they can affect some change in their daily life. And I mean, I think to a certain extent, there was a famous quote from André Breton's where he said, change life, said Rambau. No, it's not. Transform the world, Marx said. Change life, said Rambau. These two watchwords are one for us. And to a certain extent, the situation is to continue that sort of thing where there was a political critique, but there was also an interest in your daily life and your daily environment. And I think that's what appealed to a lot of, I think that's what appeals to a lot of people nowadays.
Ah, that's interesting. What I'd like to ask now that we're in 2009, what would you say is your best-selling Situationist book?
Well, I think, to be quite honest, it is still our best-selling book is Society of the Spectacle. That is one that still sells best. I suppose that's because that's the one that's gets referred to most, actually. And that's obviously, that's closely followed by the Van Eygen Revolution of Everyday Life, because, rightly or wrongly, I think those have been designated two key texts. And then obviously there's a Ken Nabb anthology and the Chris Gray anthology, which, you know, we encourage people to dip into and read as well, because that gives the anthologies give a slightly wider perspective on the evolution of the Situationists and how they arrived at the positions articulated, certainly in Society of the Spectacle, because it was quite a long journey from when they started with their involvement in Lecturism up to De Bord's sort of rejection of art, which is exemplified in Society of the Spectacle.
So which is your favourite Situationist book, then?
my favourite Situationist book is Jacques Vachon's War Letters.
Ah, oh, you're a train spotter at heart, Malcolm.
I am indeed.
So we're curious, you know, Guy Debord, you know, is this person who starts as an artist, makes these radical films, actually does carry on making films when he becomes more of a hardline politico, but he's best known for Society of Spectacle, which is his sort of searing critique of media, saturated consumer society, and looks forward to the rule of the workers' councils. So why do you think in the 70s he spent most of his time inventing the game of war?
Well, that's an interesting question, yeah. I mean, the romantic in me, right? That sounds a bit like out of Casablanca, but the romantic in me, I'd like to think it was sort of some sort of elegant Duchampian gesture, just like Duchamp is supposed to give up art to play chess. I'd like to believe that Duchamp gave up all the theory to
produce
the game. Now, obviously, this isn't true, but that's what appeals to me as a romantic. But I mean, on one level, you know, you mentioned the fact that De Bord produced books, he produced films. Why, I mean, if you think about it, why not a board game? Because one of the things that obviously intrigued the Situationist was getting a message across using whatever medium was possible. You know, if you think about it, the detourment of the cartoons, graffiti, I remember, you know, the board said, you know, you should be able to film Society of the Spectacle. So why not start putting across some of your ideas in games and that?
So do you think the game itself embodies De Boer's political, social ideas?
I think it embodies certainly a lot of his way of thinking.
And maybe it embodies a bit of Parisian cafe society, with the idea that, you know, you, like lots of cafe, would have a chess set there for people to play. So the idea was that they would then acquire the game of war, and you'd have all these young students sitting in the cafes drinking wine and playing his game and becoming infused with his ideas.
Well, yeah, I think so, because, I mean, the point is, you're right. I mean, last time I was over in Brussels, actually, which is also a place that, you know, that you have, that we went into this, what you might say was a bar, and, I mean, basically the back room was just full of chess tables. And everybody was sitting there playing. And it's an effective way. I mean, people like games. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, when I was younger, I sometimes feel that my perception of London had been dominated by a Monopoly board.
And so now you've acquired the station, King's Cross.
I've actually moved up to London. But, you know, it seems to me that it's a particularly interesting way of actually, like you said, I think the idea of people being able to just sit in Parisian cafes out in the street as they do, sipping their wine, playing a game, was a great idea. I'm sure that must have appealed to De Boer, because we all know...
He did like to tipple, didn't he?
Well, I was going to say, we all know in De Boer's youth, shall we say, that he was quite renowned for wandering around, dropping in places, drinking, and enjoying themselves generally. So, I mean, I think in a sense, it fits into a De Boerian concept. I mean, one of the things that I do think is interesting is that when De Boer came to design a game, you know, it's interesting that what he formulated is very, very different from, if you think about the serverless games that they played communally. You know, because they were the far more chance encountering games like the exquisite course of Drink New Wine, whereas this is a lot more logical, theoretical sort of game, as opposed to the serverless games, which were done more fun, tongue-in-cheek sort of thing.
You actually have to seriously learn to play this game. It's interesting, we found a lot of people who said, oh, we didn't really like the game when we first tried it out. And we said, well, how many times have you tried it out? Because it's one of those games that you sort of get into once you've played it a few times.
Well, I think it's not just... I mean, I think it's like one of the things I know we've all said, that Society of the Spectacle is not a book you can just read once. You have to read it, live with it, reread it. You have to start... almost like inhabiting the book to get the full value out of it. Because, I mean, I know when I first read the book, I wasn't sure what a lot of it was about. I just felt that something significant was being said. And as you persevere with it, you know, and as you move through life, situations occur, and it starts becoming a lot more transparent. But, I mean, obviously, like, the game's the same as the book. You've got to work at it. I mean, it's not... I mean, the point about De Boer is that De Boer, obviously, the situation is we're critical of mindless, you know, passivity, just pure consumerism. And I think both Society and the Spectacle and the board game, you know, require effort on the part of either the player or the person reading the book. And I think that's fair enough. I think.
But they are fun. I mean, the interesting thing about both Society, Spectacle and the game is that they're not just hard work, they're also good fun.
Oh, they're all good fun, and I mean, also, yeah. I mean, you know...
That's why they appeal rather than, you know, the more boring anarchist Trotskyist texts that you might stock as well.
What, the hectoring
text? Yeah, I mean, the board's got... I mean, one of the things that's very notable at the board is the board's got a very interesting writing style, actually, and some of it is quite humorous, and, you know, but this is something you would expect from people who were interested in the torment and all that sort of stuff. So there's actually an element of fun in reading these things, exactly. And, I mean, a lot of it's like there's a bit of an in-joke. You recognise where things have come from and all that sort of stuff. But I think that the longer you live with these things, the more effective they become in your, you know, the more understandable they become. And, I started reading, I can't remember when I first read Society of the Spectacle, but I'm still going back to it. And, you know, it's continual. You can continually find new ideas in there.
So, I mean... Like, saying that's quite interesting because I read it back in the 70s. But here we are. We now found our way into the 21st century.
We've left the 20th century, as Chris Gray would say.
Yeah, and there's a sort of a new generation of young people, and I think society's changed quite a lot in that way. So how do you think situationist ideas can be applied, you know, in current conditions?
Well, that's, you know, this is, as they sort of say, isn't it, the $64,000 question. I mean, certain situationist ideas are quite easy to apply. I feel I've got to get this in because it is one of my all-time favourite quotes by Debord. I think you can guess what it's going to be. Among the small number of things that I've liked and known how to do well, what I have assuredly known how to do best is drink. Although I have read a lot, I've drunk even more. Now, obviously, that is a universally applicable idea.
And we are stopping you from going to the pub, Malcolm, so we'll have to wrap up, I think, at that point. Points taken.
Anyway,
thanks a lot.
Great to have you on the radio show. And you've got your 50th anniversary coming up in November, yeah?
Yeah, we've got our 50th anniversary. We'll have a party.
Congratulations.
And obviously we'll invite you lot, and who knows, maybe you'll play the game of war.
In a pacifist bookshop.
Celebrating 50 years of a pacifist bookshop. That has a certain...
Debordian ring to it.
Debordian concept, yeah?
Okay, and right. So that's, thank you very much. That's Malcolm Hopkins from Housemans.
Five Caledonian Road, right down the King's Cross end of Caledonian Road, and
worth
a visit, you know, particularly if you're just visiting London.
Check it out.
It's handy.
Okay, so we're now going to go on to our review of the week.
Yes.
Which is one of our favourite games, actually, we discovered from playing it at the club night.
Yes, I mean, we reviewed earlier on the Freikorps game by Brian Train.
And this is a game called Red Guard.
Yes, the Chinese Cultural Revolution.
So here is, it's about the struggles inside the Chinese Communist Party in the sort of 60s, 70s, over who would dominate it.
Yes, and it's quite staggering that actually 500,000 people died in these struggles.
But we can turn it into a fun board game.
Well, but we never forget. I mean, one of the things about playing war games is we never forget that this aspect to it is that actually...
This is a real struggle.
This is a real struggle, and it had devastating consequences. And part of the reason why war games can be useful is that you can draw the lessons from those struggles without having to repeat them.
Yes, and what this game does is it allows you to play one of the leaders of the Cultural Revolution, like Deng Xiaoping or Lin Biao or Madame Mao.
There's six factions, and you can play it with two players, in which four of the factions would be dormant.
Or between two and six. It's better with six players, though. You can play it with dormant factions who basically... the other people can use when they take them over. But basically, it works best with six players.
It does indeed. And it's a very sociable game. And when we played it at the Flea Pit, we found that people pick up the concept very quickly. So in that sense, it's easy to introduce people to it. So somebody can come, arrive, grasp the rules, play the game and have fun.
And even win.
And that's, you know, before 10 o'clock, they've still got a chance for another couple of drinks before they get too drunk to play.
Or another and a quick game of Comrade Cobras. If you haven't had enough fun purging the Chinese Communist Party, you can go back in time and purge the Soviet Communist Party as well.
Absolutely.
The game is a sort of board game without a board, isn't it?
Yes, or a card game without a board.
Yeah, something like that. So you have tiles, basically, which represent... The different institutions.
These are actually cards.
Yeah, or cards, yes. So we're using the
They're called tiles.
Yes, yeah, so this is the techie gamer term for them. But they're large cards which represent the different institutions of the Chinese state.
That's right. And they've got different sorts of cards. So you've got things, some of them, you know, at first sight, don't seem very useful, like the peasant communes.
But they do have great names, like Advance in the Spirit of Lei Feng Soft Drink Bottling Plant, and Destroy All Monsters and Ghosts Commune. But you also have other ones, you know, obvious things like Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Public Security, the Politburo, the Cultural Revolution Small Group, and one of my favourite, I think, for Resonance FM listeners is the East is Red Institute for the Performing Arts. So what you do is you have little pieces?
Well, first of all, the cards, some of them, except for the peasant communes, are particular to either the People's Liberation Army, the Red Guard Unit, the Communist Party of China, or the Urban Workers Unit. And when you have the little pieces that we're going to start talking about now, they get an advantage when they are playing on the card of the same nature as them.
Yes, exactly. So you have Red Guards, and you have Army, and you have Communist Party cadre, and you have Urban Workers, and you have these little pieces, and you either, and in your go, you either deploy them to defend your institutions that you've seized, or you launch attacks against your opponents and try and seize the institutions that they control. And you have two types of attack, a subvert or a purge.
Yes, and in fact, it's the army that's very good at the purge, because if you actually purge people, they lose the pieces.
They go back into the pot.
Yeah, whereas if you subvert them, they retain them. So
yes, and but you have these, like, and also you have your little leader figure, and your leader figure can either be defending an institution, or for those people who've been temporarily knocked out of action, you can go and rally them back to the cause in your go. Yeah. And each go you pick out, so you have basically all the pieces that are not in play in a giant pot where you pick out the pieces. So which is then distributed to the various players in each turn. So that's quite good. So occasionally somebody gets three pieces, and sometimes on the turn they don't get any pieces. So that gives a nice sort of randomness to it.
You do have to have nice white lighting, because when we played it with kind of like red-orange lighting, it was hard to tell the difference between pink and orange.
Yes, and red.
Yes.
So that does, and for, again, your eyesight might have problems.
No, I think anybody's eyesight has problems with that. but yes, and so, and really, you've got the dichotomy between the People's Liberation Army, who's really good at purging and not much good at subverting, and the Communist Party of China, who can subvert but are not very good at
And the
purging.
And the Red Guard, which are brilliant at subverting and useless at purging.
No, they're middling.
Ah.
They're 3-3. See, I've got the rules in front of me. This gives me a little bit of an advantage.
And I'm just operating from memory. So, but the game is, I think what the game is good is it has this sort of group dynamic. So when one person is obviously winning, everybody else gangs up on them.
Yes, it's a very sociable game. And you also have a random events table with things like Chairman Mao drops ball at ping pong tournament. Remove one worker unit. Choose human player faction randomly. Player may choose which unit and place in pool. Pool's the place where you pick all the pieces up.
And so what we found is that, as I said, one person starts winning, everyone gangs up, and then somebody else starts winning, and everyone gangs up on them. And then it's the people who stay nice and quiet and crafty who come out on top, actually, we discovered.
Yes.
So our friend Lara Blazic, she did very well like that.
Yes.
There's a good picture on our Facebook page of her winning the game, looking most surprised.
Yes.
So that I think we highly recommend this game, actually.
Yes, well worth it. It's good. It's a game that, you know, we play it in a pub setting, and it's brilliant because people can come along, pick the game up really quickly, get in the swing of things, and then even if you're not doing so well, the chances are other people want to keep you in the game because they will gang up against the person who's winning.
And you can make a comeback. I mean, that's the other thing, is people can sort of look like they lost the game, they're only down to one institution, and suddenly, well, before you know it, they're actually starting to win the game. And isn't it interesting, the way the game ends is quite funny, because you have this little Mao chit in the pool, and as you're picking up pieces, eventually Mao arrives as a piece, and that means he's dropped dead. And that's the point when the Cultural Revolution battle is decided, the person who's got the dominant faction.
Yes, and you have the possibility of civil war with the chaos building up at the same time.
Yes, exactly, which stops people doing too many purges, which I think is quite a good idea.
There's one bit where Madame Mao performs Hello Dolly, and this means the chaos factor shoots up.